Investors Chronicle.
Welcome one and all to the Companies and Markets show, in which we at the Investors Chronicle discuss some of the big stories of the moment and our latest analysis of a variety of companies, large and small. Today, after a week in which Shell became the latest business to make noises about leaving the UK market, we are talking about British Bargains, some shares that our team think have been unfairly left behind as a result of the doom and gloom surrounding London listings in general. That's our cover feature this week, so we'll be going into some of the thinking behind that in a moment, as well as discussing two of the companies featured. One of those is Coats, the FTSE 250 thread maker, whose fortunes might just be starting to improve again. We'll look at its prospects in more detail later on. And finally, we will consider the outlook for another storied company in our separate Result of the Week segment, where we'll be discussing ceramics manufacturer Churchill China. On the show today to share their views are Julian Hoffman, Mark Robinson, and Gemma Slingo. Julian, I'll begin with you. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you, Dan. Yes, chipper, thank you.
Excellent. Well, you, as you know, are the author of the cover story this week, the British Bargains piece, or certainly the bulk of it. We've got contributions from a variety of companies' writers in there. I've mentioned Shell already, but why don't you give us a little bit of background just for those who are perhaps unaware for some reason of what's been going on in recent months with regard to the London market?
Yeah, it kind of felt to me to see if there was any life in the old dog. And so I looked at the value case for the UK equities market. But I quickly found out that this was quite difficult to do because the market is so unloved that almost every measure of value that you can use is so cheap as to be almost meaningless. So it was it became an exercise really in looking at the fundamentals of how to assess companies and industries in a way that not only considers how cheap the shares are in relation to the company, but whether they are resilient and potentially growing businesses. It almost sort of reignited the need to do in-depth research in a way that has kind of gone out of fashion, I think, in the last 10 years or so. You tend to stick to sort of ratios and measures, but you actually had to go into the nuts and bolts of how a company works and what its ultimate market was in order to form a view. So in that way, it became a generally more interesting exercise than just saying, well, this is cheap and that's cheap in relation to its long-term value. And we sort of looked at it in a more holistic way, I think, and it became about a much better and more informative exercise, I think, because of that.
Indeed,
the one way we did look at it was to try and we resurrected a genuine value screen, which Algie Hall, formerly of this parish, developed a while back because the market was facing a similar problem, and in that. Prior to a rotation of intervalue, there were a lot of cheap shares around at the time, and so Algie came up with a screen that tries to adjust for this phenomenon by using the PEG ratio and things like dividend and debt growth, and you put them all together into a formula, and it comes out with some interesting potential companies which we then analyzed and looked at. And so yes, the feature runs through the methodology behind that, and we also dip into things like F scores from Josef Piotrowski's Piotrowski's measures, and it's just a way really of getting away from saying, well, what is cheap? I think, you know, cheap is not the same as value really in this context.
Yeah, it is an interesting point in the context where, albeit there are some UK companies which are still fairly richly valued, in the context where there has nonetheless been a broad, widespread derating, you really do, as you say, have to go a little bit deeper to work out where the value is and what's maybe just a value trap. The genuine value screen is one way of doing that, as you say, and as we discuss in the piece. We have, as with any screen, there are some issues, I think, with relying on one screen to the exclusion of everything else. And of course, what we therefore try and do is pick out some companies that do stand out for a number of fundamental reasons as well, rather than just being screened and saying this company must be a good investment, etc.
Yeah, I mean, it gives such a false picture. I think that's the problem with it at the best of times. But, at a time when the nature of valuation is so difficult to define, it can just throw up very potentially difficult value traps if you're not careful. Having said that, there were some... Yeah, I did go back to the literature a bit to see if anyone had anything to say about this in a historical context. And naturally, of course, we always go back to Benjamin Graham when you talk about value. But his point in this debate was quite interesting. I thought that it's often forgotten in the context of, say, US shares, which are much higher rated, that there is a perception that they tend not to pay out very much in dividends, which is generally true for the most part. But that's only a phenomenon of the last 40, 50 years. And Benjamin Graham writes in his book that the first duty of a management is to give reasons, compelling reasons not to pay out dividends. So in the context of the value that we're looking at, you have to consider that there tends to be this mentality that dividends are a kind of expression of failure or an expression of slow growth. And actually, if you look at it the other way around, it could be just the ideal that there is no worthwhile capital investment to make with the money, and in that sense, it is the right of shareholders to receive their dividends. So I don't think people should write that off necessarily as a sign of a decline or a moribund kind of company or share. I think it's actually a more fundamental expression of how the market works.
Mm. Yes, it was interesting to read Robin Hardy, another of our colleagues this week, talk about the FTSE All Share return over the last decade, which capital return I think is about 20%, but with dividends is 70%. So clearly there is a big part to play there, even if that's not captured by the index returns we see every day, because dividends aren't included in those typically. As you say as well, that has been a stick to beat the UK market with, hasn't it? Certainly the large caps, that these are old, staid companies which can't do anything else other than pay dividends. But as we've discussed at various times in recent months, dividends themselves are not to be sniffed at. Why don't we talk about one of the companies picked out as a result of this, which is quite a cyclical business and one that has had some tough times even in recent weeks in terms of how it's talking about its current conditions and the current market conditions, and that's DFS.
Yes, actually, DFS is a furniture seller, sort of doyen of out-of-town retail parks, I think would be a fair summary. It's an interesting company. It sort of goes to the heart of why research into how companies actually work is kind of vital when you're thinking about value investing in this context. DFS, as you said, is a very cyclical business. It's tied to levels of interest rates. If people feel in material terms a bit wealthier, they'll go and buy a big ticket piece of furniture. If they're moving house, which is often a sign of decent economic conditions, that's also a trigger for a large purchase like that. The interesting point about DFS, as you said, that they have gone through this rather difficult period in the first half of the year, which was pretty forgettable. But the key thing is, when you looked into the way they manage their balance sheet, is that it's a very robust and resilient kind of company. So they're very good at finding savings within the business. So they targeted, I think, 16 million, but they actually found £22 million of savings. And it's all about how to manage cash flow in that context. So if your core business is under pressure on a macro level, you should then be able to adjust your working capital, the way you use your assets, in such a way that you generate cash. And DFS is really good at that. It has a long record of converting profits into cash at very high levels. So over the past few years, well over 150% cash conversion. And that went negative the last year and into the first half, but that's now projected to come back positive again. So you can see that the way that they manage their cash flow is quite integral to how how well run the company is, and it's a good indication of that, I think. So you, what I think is that at that point you think, well, if the rating now on a, let's take the PEG rating is 0.1, which anything below one is considered value, and you could even add in a Piotrowski score of 6. So 6 is sort of 3/4 of the way towards the highest score, which is 9. That actually starts to look a more decent proposition. It's a way of you know, we can see that the company is performing well at an operational level in spite of the conditions, at the same time as being quite reasonably priced. So I think that was the way that I took that that company in and analyzed it, and then recommended it as a buy, even despite the fact that the last half wasn't anything to talk about really in terms of profitability. But that doesn't mean that it won't come back. So you know, if they're doing the underlying things correctly, then when macro growth returns, whenever that is, or interest rates change, it'll be well positioned.
Yeah, this does seem like one where you have to have a relatively long or medium term time horizon, don't you, because of the challenges in the short term. But that's in many ways what investing is all about. Just a couple of things to pick up on there as well. The Piotrowski score you mentioned, it's the same as the F score we referred to earlier, which we do go into in the piece. It's effectively 9 different metrics on which you can grade a company, isn't it?
Yes, that's right. So they score 6, the top mark. They have to score a top mark in each metric. You assign the column to that mark. So I mean, they score well on 6 out of 9 measures. So that puts them in the, you know, just under the top 30% centile of companies by Piotrowski score. So it's yes, I mean, it's an interesting, it's another measure that you can use just to guide your thinking. And I would say that in combination with a PEG ratio gives you a good idea that there is a value proposition there, I think, that's sustainable.
And you referred a couple of times to the recent half-year results. This is a company which has its first half of the year, and I think that runs to the 24th of December or something strange like that, rather than the 31st. But yes, its first half is the calendar second half. So it has just put out some numbers last month, which did show some pressure. But as you say, there are positive signs there. Another one perhaps is the fact they are still gaining market share, it seems, I believe.
Yes, I mean, they've only fallen, the sort of market share has fallen by 1%, but the total market has fallen by 10%. So there's like a net 9% gain.
Yeah, their volume drop was 1% in a 10% falling market.
That's correct. Yeah. Okay. So they're holding their own, really, against the difficult market positions and conditions. And I think that's a decent sign that it's a quality business.
Indeed.
And it's also a property business, really. I mean, it owns a lot of, owns or leases a lot of big boxes. And part of the reason it can expand or contract the balance sheet quite so quickly is that that property portfolio can be juggled around, either leased out or leases can be ended, and that gives it a lot more flexibility about its footprint, really, and the amount of cash that's tied up in property.
Yeah, well, another potential tailwind for a lot of these cyclical businesses is that the cycle may be improving somewhat, as you say, interest rate cuts may be on the way, and generally economic activity is ticking up a little bit, albeit from quite a low base. So certainly one to keep an eye on. We're going to turn to another of the companies mentioned now, though, and that's Coats, as I said at the top. Gemma, you have written about Coats, and we discussed Coats on the show not too long ago. Since then, they've had some more results, and it does seem like some of their problems, they're a little bit further down the line in terms of working through some of those.
I think so. So there are full year results out, and they basically told us something we've suspected for a little while now. So basically, it's making great progress internally, which is allowing it to keep its profits steady, even though the background is very difficult and revenue is actually falling. So in 2023, which was the year to the end of December, revenue fell by 14% organically. So wasn't great, but adjusted operating profits stayed flat at $233 million. And statutory operating profits actually increased a tiny bit. And you also had this situation where cash generation was improving. So it seems to be a company that is really holding its own in in a very difficult market. And I think one of the key difficulties has been this destocking, which, you know, you've seen across huge numbers of companies. But basically, retailers have been, you know, getting rid of stock, and there's been this weaker demand from consumers for clothes and shoes. And now everyone's in the position of basically waiting for the destocking to end. And there were some hopeful signs in the 2023 results. Management said there was evidence that customer inventory levels are normalising in apparel. So sort of the first signs of spring, I suppose. It's a bit of a different story in footwear because apparently the destocking cycle started a bit later than clothes. Not completely understanding why, but that's what management said. So they seem to be thinking that will be a bit further in the future when footwear starts to recover. But investors seem to be feeling positive, I think.
Yes. And I mean, as a thread maker, it has a variety of strands to its business, you could say, if you want to make a hilarious pun like that. One of which is the, which again, we spoke about a little bit before, the sustainable thread side of the business. And in these latest figures, that does seem to be, you know, going pretty well at the moment.
It seems to be, and they're putting it way higher up in the results than they used to, which suggests, you know, management wants to make a bit of a song and dance of it. So the sale of 100% recycled thread products grew by 44% in 2023, and sort of total sales number of that was $172 million. To put that in context, the group's total revenue was almost $1.4 billion. So it is still quite a niche area, but I think the key thing to note is that it is extremely fast growing. And as I mentioned in the podcast, you know, a few months ago when I looked at the fashion world, it does seem that retailers are increasingly interested in at least a green image, and sort of if there is a sustainable thread alternative, that might be something they're very interested in. So it seems to be sort of an interesting growth pathway, and the analysts seem quite excited by it.
And one part of the operational progress they've made is on margins, and they've reached targets ahead of time. How have they done this?
So basically, they've been on a massive cost-cutting drive. So for a couple of years now, they've been selling businesses, been consolidating warehouses. Labour costs really have been a really big issue. So they've been cutting staff in some regions. And another big decision they made was basically to move some of their manufacturing facilities out of North America, where labour might be hard to come by and staff demand higher wages, to Mexico, where basically they can get things cheaper. So that seems to have made quite a big difference to the overall cost base. So before the pandemic, margins sat at about 14.3%, and they've now widened to 17%, which is a year ahead of the management schedule. So it does seem to be making great progress, again, against a backdrop that really isn't conducive to internal efficiency.
Mm. I saw some analysts talking the other day about this Mexican manufacturing process and saying it's going to scale up further this year, so there's more gains to be had there potentially, especially as that labour cost advantage is about 80% relative to the US, which is quite a big increase, clearly, or decrease if you want to put it that way. The other thing to talk about that came up a few months ago now is the pension deficit. Once again, an improving outlook on this front.
Definitely. So as with lots of old companies, it's got a defined benefit pension scheme, which has been a headache for years and years now because it's basically had a funding deficit and it's just sucked in cash every month. I was having a quick look over the figures before we started, and in 2021, there was $42 million paid in. Following year, it was $43 million, you know, just a big drain on what could be being returned to shareholders, basically. But in December last year, it made its payment, and it made an accelerated payment of £10 million. And that effectively meant they were able to switch off their ongoing contributions. So that means that there should be a free cash flow tailwind of about $30 million a year, which everyone seems fairly pleased about. It's not sort of guaranteed that it will stay perfect forever. So if the scheme reverts into a deficit position, those repair payments will be switched back on again. But management did say, you know, it's working towards fully de-risking the pension scheme over the medium term. So for now, at least, the outlook is much more positive.
Yeah, that does imply what we've seen happening to a lot of pension schemes as gilt yields have risen, doesn't it? I.e. selling it to an insurer and effectively taking that liability off their hands and allowing them to focus the capital allocation elsewhere. The valuation then on Coats, I mean, PEG ratio is something you've looked at as well with regard to this company. There are some positive signs here in general, despite improving fortunes for the shares over recent weeks and months, it's still looking relatively attractive.
I think so. So just on the sort of basic price to earnings ratio, it currently trades on a forward P ratio of 11.2, which is a little bit lower than its 5-year average of 12.1. But yeah, as you and Julian spoke about, we're also interested in the PEG ratio, which basically looks at a company's PE ratio and divides it by its earnings growth. So it basically takes into account its growth prospects. And for Coats, its PEG ratio is currently 0.9 and its long-term average was about 1. So that looks pretty encouraging, given that a ratio of 1 or below is usually considered pretty good value. But I'd say, you know, just away from the technical metrics, you've basically got a company that's managed to make huge leaps forward from an operational perspective against a really horrible backdrop. So you would think logically, once the demand does pick up, it should be in a position to really thrive. But we will see, I suppose.
Indeed. Before we move on, I also wanted to talk briefly about the performance materials arm, because clothing and footwear, I think, is about 3/4 of revenue. This division is the remaining quarter, and it makes a lot of interesting things which you wouldn't necessarily think straight away. I think in relation to things like telecoms, cables and things like that. And there have been some issues with this division, but how's it looking at the moment?
Yeah, it's a weird division. So it makes things for like firefighters' uniforms and like the seats of cars, the sort of thread that holds those together. So it's an interesting one to look at, but it has been having quite a rough time. So organic revenue was down by 17% in 2023, so it was the worst performing division from that perspective. And partly it was sort of a difficult cyclical moment, but management also mentioned that customers are increasingly insourcing production of that kind of thread. And that doesn't seem to be a thing that many analysts are talking about yet, but that does seem to be a bit of an issue, because if there is this structural move away from using a massive company like Coats, that could have a long-term impact on that division. But at the moment, the focus seems to be on sort of more positive sides for the shoes and footwear and clothes, but we'll have to see, I guess.
The signs I've seen, the management comments, as they probably would do, have suggested recently that some of that insourcing has started to reverse. So I'm sure they hope that will continue. And they're looking at a lot of US tender activity as well, I think, with the various stimulus programs going on over there. But we'll keep an eye on that. Well, Coats founded 1755 is clearly, as you said, Gemma, a very old business, one that's been around for a long time. And we're going to turn to another 18th century business now in our final segment. That is Churchill China, the ceramics maker. Now, this, I should say, is separate from the bargains we've been discussing in the rest of the show, which, as that might imply, we don't have it on a buy rating currently, Mark. Nonetheless, it's a very interesting business and has just put out some full-year figures, which you covered. What are your thoughts on how they look?
Yeah, well, it's a company that I'm reasonably familiar with, actually, because I've been looking at their story prior to the pandemic and what's panned out since then as well. The results themselves were well received by the market, albeit on some fairly low volumes again, but I'll come to that in a moment. When you look at the return on capital for the group at the moment, obviously that, as you would expect, some longer term impacts from the lockdowns and the effective closure of the hospitality industry in the UK and elsewhere. And that's still in evidence. So, you know, the return on capital, it also reflects the fact that Churchill China has kept on investing in plant, even when their markets had effectively closed down as well. So they've been upgrading and automating different parts of the production process, and this is reflected on those returns as well. But it's worth pointing out that though they're off their pre-pandemic levels at the moment, they're ahead of their 5-year average rate. So it's sort of moving up on that basis, which is and even when you look at the net margin as well, which is around about 10% at the moment, against I think it was 13.5% back in 2019. The 5-year average rate is about 7.8% as well. So again, it shows that things are heading in the right direction. And that's also reflected in the free cash flow yield as well. That's recovering quite strongly at the moment, which is good. Mm-hmm. The order book itself is back to pre pandemic levels, although we can't really tell. You know, you need to dig down a little bit deeper when you're looking at orders as well. Part of the reason that it struggled in that sort of pandemic era as well was due to staffing issues. And it's a little bit more complex than many other companies as well. They made about 130 people redundant over the course of last year. But the important factor there is that a lot of the people there were on a contract basis. And so they're not nearly as efficient as workers that have been there for any length of time. And so the residual workforce they've gotten there is now far more experienced. They're more efficient as a result of it. You know, and again, that was an after effect of the pandemic as well. So things, you know, we shouldn't necessarily just look at those capital returns in isolation. I think things are actually picking up for the group a bit.
Mm. Yeah, we should say that Churchill, the majority of their revenues come from the hospitality industry, which you referred to there. They are a commercial ceramics manufacturer, more so than selling to retail these days. Nonetheless, you look at the website, their Instagram, as I did earlier, there's some quite interesting designs there. They're not there's not just, you know, plain white china that's being bought in bulk by companies. I think even companies nowadays want a nice fancy bowl or plate, don't they, for their own Instagram, for their own social media feeds. But that does mean they have been exposed to the hospitality industry's own pandemic issues, doesn't it? I think on the staffing side as well, that the sense you get from the latest figures, don't you, is that whereas lots of industries have been dealing with destocking and things like that, it's almost the opposite. They've been struggling to get enough stuff made, or certainly to reduce lead times to levels they'd want in recent years. They seem to be making progress now. Hiring more permanent employees should hopefully help with that, in that you get a more skilled work base over time and you increase productivity, which seems to be something they're investing in as well. Can we talk a bit about the costs in general in the business, though? There are those labor costs and also energy costs. I mean, making pottery is an energy-intensive business.
Well, it's a double hit as well, because the same factors that have weighed on Churchill China, increased costs across the board, including labor and energy, they've also impacted the hospitality market too. And so managers there are looking to keep a lid on costs, and that was especially true during that period of high energy prices, as you mentioned. Again, the automation process should help this as well. Whereas Churchill have been investing heavily in that, but the benefits won't actually start to come through until later this year, by all accounts. So all the main benefits won't start to come through till later in this year. They're still allocating CapEx funds of about £5 million per year. So that hasn't changed. And they've also been building up inventories to increase those efficiencies as far as delivery goes, in anticipation that demand levels will retrace, which they will over time. You know, when you think of what happened after the pandemic as well, there was it had to deal with other things. It amounted to a damage limitation exercise, really, because they're in the middle of integrating an acquisition. Another Stoke-on-Trent-based company, Dudson Limited, another sort of ancient company there, but that collapsed into administration in April 2019. And so by the time that the disruption came in the wider economy, they were still having to deal with that. So what they did then as well, they curtailed any share-based payments and just to lower their working capital requirements as well. But to show how forward-thinking they are, and I guess they're locked in a way, they're also dealing with contingency planning that was relating to Brexit as well. So during that period, they opened or they put forward a distribution centre in Rotterdam to offset any logistical problems. And that just obviously related to any potential problems with Brexit. And, you know, when they first hatched that idea, the nature of our trading relationship with Europe hadn't been finalized yet. And so that shows some forward thinking. It also shows that they see the main area of growth as in Europe too. I might just mention before you you noted that they're actually quite high-end ceramics from Churchill, and that was again a deliberate decision on the part of management as well, because they decided to go up the value chain. A lot of companies, manufacturing companies in the UK, have done that, because obviously if you're just selling plain white ceramics into the hospitality market, if that's all they wanted, then companies, pubcos and hotels, could just go to Southeast Asia and source much cheaper material there. So it's value added stuff, and that actually should support the business over time as well, because you know, if you sell into a niche product, you're likely you're not as exposed to relative cost benefits of other manufacturing centers, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, I believe they focus on a bone shiner, don't they, rather than earthenware and stoneware. Yeah. And things like that, for people who know about these things, which I increasingly do, as my wife has become an amateur ceramicist in recent months.
Oh, really?
And years.
Very nice.
So yeah, we've got a, you know, our own collection of pottery at home now, but it's interesting to see what the mass production is doing, isn't it? One other thing I wanted to talk about in relation to Churchill was, you alluded to it a little bit there, but that revenue share geographically, because it's been fairly static for at least half a decade, if not longer. It's about 40% in the UK, about the same continental Europe, 10% in the US and a bit elsewhere. I'm thinking here of the other listed pottery maker, Port Merion, which is more retail focused, I believe, and has really been caught out in recent years by some of its overseas exposure, places like South Korea. I think that all went a little bit awry a few years back. Churchill, though, seems to be quite well set on this split, and I'm not sure if you're aware of its expansion plans or its intention geographically and where it wants to focus in future outside of Europe or in Europe, as you mentioned, with that new factory.
I think the main focus tends to be in Europe, and it's easy to understand why, given that they've developed the infrastructure there, including an experienced sales and marketing team too. So, and you know, their market penetration is still relatively low across the channel, and so we can it's easy enough to see why they would concentrate on there. So I think with Port Merion too as well, they had a bit of a nightmare in their North American businesses too. I haven't looked at them all, because I think Simon Thompson reviews the company from time to time there, but they had specific issues going on there too. Yeah, so I think that's where the growth is going to come from in the future, and you know, perhaps they will start to see the benefits shortly as well, because presumably along with efficiency benefits, you're also going to see capacity build because of these investments in automation and so on.
Final point on the shares themselves and both the valuation but also the liquidity, because Churchill China, it is a pretty small company nowadays, 130 million market cap. The results were well received, but in February I think the shares were down about a quarter. They had a big run up at the end of last year as well. It has been quite volatile, in short. How do you see the kind of free float liquidity situation and maybe also the valuation at the moment?
Yeah, the valuation is a little bit of a difficult one. I mean, they're trading below their 2-year average on a forward forecast earnings basis. But you know, as we point out, there are still some uncertainties over the timing of when demand will return in the hospitality market. So I mean, we can't really sort of make a commitment, even though they're relatively cheap, and I think the dividend yield is okay as well. Off the top of my head, I think it might be about 3%. They have been volatile, as you mentioned, but when you look at it as well, they have got a fairly high level of insider ownership as well, about 31%, and it's always better, or we always think it's better, when management has got some skin in the game. That's usually a positive note as well. But when you look at the volatility rates going back to, I went back as far as September, and you've had, since then, you've had 5 days which you've seen spikes in the volumes. But for the most part, they're at historical levels, which are quite low. And you also see that, you know, the company has got a fairly large spread as well, which again points to a lack of liquidity in the market. But I think they're just tightly held. I think there's like 10 large institutional shareholders who keep a fairly tight grip on the shares as well. So, you know, I think it's one of these ones where you've just got to look at the trading narrative and work it out yourself. I will make one point about the company. Their results are a pleasure to read because management don't try and gloss over anything. So if you're a shareholder, you get hold of a preliminary report, or even better, get hold of a copy of the IC. You're getting exactly what it says on the tin with them, I think.
Yeah, no, I do agree with that. They are a good read, which is all too rare nowadays. All they need to do now is get rid of the occasional reference to tabletop solutions, which I think they describe their pottery as, which feels like a synonym too far. But yes, there is an interesting point as well about the holders. There are some high profile fund managers who hold the shares in their small cap funds, Marlborough, I think, Lion Trust too. So there is still some faith there as well. That, though, unfortunately, is all we have time for today. So thank you very much, Mark, for that. Thank you to Gemma, to Julian as well, and to our producer, Maddie Apthorpe. We'll be back next time with another Companies and Markets show.